Hello and welcome to a podcast about murder. I'm Jem and I'm here with Freya, as always, for another conversation about murder. How are you on this fine day?
For another conversation. Make it sound thrilling, why don't you?
For another adrenaline-filled debate.
Okay, good. That's better.
So how are you?
I am good. Yeah, I'm getting a little bit of a weird day. I'm still not totally settled into the new place, so I've got a lot of stuff that's still sort of like not in the right place, and it's a bit annoying. So it's just sort of, yeah, but that's all. Other than that, it's good. How about you?
Yeah, pretty good. I had a lecture this morning that was quite interesting on poetry.
Okay. Good. Now that we're through with the...
Now that we could pretend to care about what the other one's doing in their everyday lives. Today we'll be discussing another historical case, this time that takes place in Renaissance Italy. Mm. So today we'll be delving into the life and crimes of professional poisoner Giulia Tofana.
Mm.
Giulia Tofana lived in Renaissance Italy during the middle of the 17th century. Much about her life is a mystery, but Giulia might just be the most successful serial killer you've never heard of. A poisoner who is thought to have helped over 600 women find a permanent solution to problem husbands, remaining uncaught for around 20 years.
Wow. It's a long career of serial killing.
Well, especially back in the day.
Yes. Although one could argue it was easier to get away with stuff like that.
Well, I guess because you could literally just be like, create a new identity and no one would question that.
Yeah, there wasn't that much forensics and stuff, I guess.
So one of the interesting things about this case is that poisoners, especially female ones, were so common in Italy during this time that it's actually difficult for historians to piece together Giulia's life without accidentally ascribing tales and information to her story that are actually from the lives of other poisoners active in the region.
Mm.
And as always, with very old cases like this, it's sort of just something that comes with the territory. Over time, the information tends to get muddied.
Mm.
However, Giulia Tofana is thought to have been born in Palermo, on the island of Sicily, at some point in the early part of the 17th century.
I've never been to Sicily. Have you?
Me neither. I've never been that far south in Italy.
Yeah, I'd like to go. I hear it's nice.
There are no portraits of Giulia, but she has been described as being quite beautiful. Not that that matters, but... interesting detail.
I mean, I guess...
I suppose it's interesting that that's what stands out.
Yeah, and also, like, I guess there's this stereotype of the kind of bitter, spurned woman serial killer who's usually, like, romantically challenged and ugly, you know? I don't know. Evil women are always painted as unattractive. Actually, that's not 100% true.
Well,
do you know what? Never mind, I take that back.
Well, because then you have the other side of it, which is, like, femme fatale, that obviously beautiful women are evil.
Right.
And evil influences on men.
Big contradiction circle, as usual.
Anyway. A young widow, Giulia led an independent life and ran a cosmetics business, manufacturing and selling makeup to local women. She was fascinated by apothecaries, which were the pharmacies of the time, and could often be found watching the chemists go about their daily business as they mix their medicines. In mid-1600s Italy, marriage pairings were often selected by family, with women not able to opt out of the arrangement. Women at the time lacked basic rights and freedoms, so once they married, their lives were under the complete control of their husbands. If a woman managed to avoid being auctioned off to a man, single life was unforgiving. Without much social or financial capital, single women often ended up relying on sex work to survive. So many accepted unwanted marriages as the best option, despite facing extremely poor treatment from their husbands. Men had the freedom to beat and abuse their wives without facing any potential consequences, and with the cultural norms of the time and the strong presence of the Catholic Church, there was no way for an unhappy spouse to divorce the other.
Hmm. Makes you feel a bit grateful for our current situation.
Oh, yeah.
A bit better where we are.
Things aren't great, but it's so much better than it was even 100 years ago, let
and
alone
there's,
in
there's,
the 17th
there are
century.
Still women facing these kinds of conditions as well.
Mm. In the words of Christine de Pizan, Italian writer and poet of the 14th century, How many women are there who, because of their husband's harshness, spend their weary lives in the bond of marriage in greater suffering than if they were slaves?
It's a very sad quote.
Yeah, it's sad to see it put down so succinctly, in a way. Mm. So the only way out of a bad marriage was if one of you died. And in some cases, this would lead to desperate actions by women who wanted to escape their husbands. Being a respected widow was an attractive life path for many Renaissance women. And that's where Julia came in. The demand for a clean, simple way for women to take matters into their own hands discreetly presented an irresistible opportunity to add a side hustle to her makeup business. Herself a young widow, it's unknown if Julia's first criminal act as a poisoner was to dispose of her own husband.
Hmm.
Around 1633, Julia began mixing poisons to conceal as makeup she could sell to customers who wanted to kill their husbands quickly and without a trace. At the time, of course, there was no such thing as a toxicology screen. Although the first forensic autopsy had taken place in Bologna 300 years earlier, the science was still in its infancy and held to the technology of the time. It was very difficult to prove a death by poisoning, and in many cases these deaths would be easily mistaken for other natural causes or illnesses.
Even nowadays,
yeah.
You find people, or like in the last kind of 30 odd years, you find people who've gotten away with murder by poisoning because many poisonings do just appear like a natural illness.
Mm. Yeah, I guess that's part of the appeal, shall we say, of poison.
And that's the benefit of living with your victim as well, because you can very discreetly take care of them.
Yeah. And it's also because it tends to be something that builds up, well, not necessarily, but it can build up over time, so it would seem like a natural illness that's been developing. So it's no wonder then that poisoning was such a popular method of murder at the time, particularly among women.
Mm.
Julia specialised in a poisoning blend thought to have been made from a combination of arsenic, lead and belladonna, also known as deadly nightshade, a concoction which was named Aqua Tofana. Aqua Tofana was an incredibly potent poison, and the small amount required to kill meant it was easily disguised. The women who used Aqua Tofana purchased it in a very small container that looked no different from any other powdered makeup when sat amongst a woman's typical cosmetics collection. Julia also disguised Aqua Tofana, sort of ironically, as a religious-themed healing oil, a small bottle decorated with the image of St. Nicholas of Bari.
That's very brazen, especially for the time as like an incredibly religious country, Italy, even now, but like back then. So it's almost like...
It's quite a ballsy move, but I think that's quite cool. It's also kind of like so brazen that no one would think to look there.
Mm.
This disguise gave rise to another of the names for Aqua Tofana, Manna di San Nicola. Manna meaning a miraculous nourishment or healing from the divine. So it's incredibly ironic for it to be called this. The poison happened to have no taste, smell, or colour, so it could easily be slipped into any food or drink. It could kill with as little as 4 drops, and drops could be administered over time, even weeks, to arouse the least possible suspicion. Symptoms of Aqua Tofana poisoning began with tiredness and weakness, evolving into stomach aches, vomiting, diarrhea, and dehydration. These signs all mimicked common illnesses, and the poisoning progressed slowly enough that a victim would have enough time and presence of mind to sort out their last affairs, including the will that would leave their murderer in a comfortable position.
This all works out quite well.
It's quite a neat plan.
Hmm.
The final death was a dramaless slip into unconsciousness. The fact that it has no colour or smell also reminds me of that scene in The Princess Bride with the cup swapping with the poison that's completely undetectable. Have you seen The Princess Bride? You're looking at me like I'm crazy.
No. I guess not. I just never... It just didn't happen.
How is this possible? You've not seen The Princess Bride?
Yeah, I guess...
Well, anyway...
Is it got... Who's the main guy?
Carrie something.
Oh, okay. It's not who I thought.
And the princess is Robin Wright.
Okay, I don't know those names. Never mind.
There's loads of, like, quite well-known people in it.
Okay. I'll Mandy just take Patinkin. Your... Huh?
Mandy Patinkin?
No.
Look,
you can reel off cast members from The Princess Bride all day, or we can
well you would
not do that.
you asked.
Did I?
You were like, who's in it? Who's the main guy?
I asked who's the main guy. I didn't ask for the IMDb page.
I was trying to think of who you might be thinking of that you would know in it. Anyway. I'm sure you've noticed the connection between Aqua Tofana and Julia's last name, Tofana.
I have.
You've recognised an identical word.
I have passed, like, literally reception grade English.
But it may not be the relationship you'd first expect, because Aqua Tofana wasn't Julia's invention.
Hmm.
The creation of Aqua Tofana is attributed to a woman named Teofania Diadomo, an adept poisoner who was executed in July 1633 for her crimes, including the murder of her own husband. So how did Julia come to possess the name and the recipe? The theory suggested by historians is that Teofania was actually Julia's mother. Julia may have adapted her mother's first name into a last name for herself, which was quite a common thing to do at the time, and then taken after her in more than just name, becoming a crafty poisoner and developing her own recipes for her mother's masterpiece, Aqua Tofana. After all, Julia's career as a poisoner is thought to have begun in 1633, the very same year Teofania was executed. So this may have been a case of a daughter taking over her mother's business.
Hmm.
According to historians, business-minded Julia didn't act alone for long. She moved from Sicily to Naples and then to Rome as she expanded her operation. With the makeup business as a cover, she worked with as many as six other women to produce and sell Aqua Tofana. Her criminal gang was even said to include a local Catholic priest who supplied the arsenic needed.
Hmm. Not sure. See, again, this is, again, is like kind of just strange to me because it seems completely at odds with the religion itself. But yeah. Then, on the other hand, we don't really need to go into the ways in which the Catholic Church has sort of diverged completely from most of the core principles of their supposed religion. So,
no, and
many, and it's the case for many religions, not just Catholicism. So I don't want to seem like I'm just picking on them. But
no, but I also think it's like such a norm at the time that it's almost like, yes, everyone is Catholic, we don't think about it, that like that leaves room for a lot of people to develop their own sort of,
I see what you mean,
but yeah, quite strange that this priest is like getting in on it. I'm not sure. I presumably for the monetary, like the financial aspect.
I can
aspect.
Only assume that it must have been, there must have been a financial gain.
It would be cool if he was just like, no, shitty husbands, I'm in on it. Like, I'm all over this.
It's good.
So one of the women Julia worked with, Girolama Spara, is thought to have been Julia's own daughter. Girolama would take over leadership of the Rome poisoning ring after Julia and continue its practices for 8 years. And so the torch was passed down a third generation, if you believe Teofania Diadomo passed her craft on to Julia, who would potentially be her daughter.
Hmm.
So who knows if this line of artful female poisoners extended further behind Teofania?
Yeah, or after? I'm not sure if Girolima had a daughter.
Not sure, but would have been possible. But I suppose all of this is...
Maybe they're still at it today.
Yeah. In cahoots with the local Catholic priests. But no, but I guess also the sort of... the fashion for poison, like there was like a period in Europe where poisoning was like a huge problem, and I guess once that ended, presumably however many generations down the line that was, it all sort of would have petered out. At some point during the 1650s, Julia's luck ran out. She was careful with her sales, typically only providing Aqua Tofana to those who came vetted by other customers, or women she already knew personally. But eventually, one customer, who had purchased Aqua Tofana planning to kill her husband, suddenly had a change of heart. Just as the unsuspecting man was about to tuck into some soup she'd laced with the poison. When the woman stopped her husband from eating the soup, he was immediately suspicious. The woman ended up admitting what she'd done. Her husband turned her in, at which point the woman gave up Julia's name, exposing the undercover poison factory to the authorities.
Hmm.
Julia was now a wanted woman and went on the run. So after this event, it all becomes quite... I mean, not that it's been, not that the information has been clear thus far, but it's there's a lot of speculation as to what happened in the later years of Julia's life.
Hmm.
Some historians believe that Julia sought asylum within a convent after fleeing from the law.
Hmm.
Because of the entwining of Julia's story with that of other local poisoners, there is some disagreement about what happened next, as well as the true date and circumstances of Julia's death. There are some who claim she was never caught and actually died in her sleep of natural causes in 1651, leaving her daughter to take over the business until she herself was caught and executed in 1659. But this is uncertain. In another version of the story, Julia remained successfully hidden, possibly for many years, and continued to work on her poisoning business from within the church that concealed her. It's thought that she was generous to the poor in the community, and of course also had the support of many local women, allowing her to evade capture by relying on their help.
Yeah, kind of like an almost like a Robin Hood type vibe, where she's like the woman of the people kind of thing. And they're all sort of helping, or like a Pablo Escobar almost situation.
Because of the circumstances that women lived in at the time, there must be quite a sort of positive sentiment towards her by many people, and perhaps even not just women, but people in society in general who would obviously feel bad for the mistreatment suffered by many wives. So that could also explain the sort of support she seems to have.
Mm.
This version of her tale ends when rumours of her activities reach... Do you say papal? Papal? The authorities of the Pope? I meant to look this up before I started recording and I forgot.
Yeah, I this is such a weird word. And actually when I saw it, I have to admit, like, I had a vague cognizance of what it meant, but I wasn't like 100% sure what that meant. And I did look it up, but I'm not sure if it's it can't be PayPal. I mean, it can't be that. Papal? I mean, think just imagining that it's Italian.
Yeah. Papal?
Sounds I'm about looking right. It
up just to see.
The Pope's
his like gang.
Mob. Shall we say? His goons.
Well, on Merriam-Webster it says papal, which is weird. Papal authorities? I'm going to go with that.
You're just going to rewrite history anyway and decide what you're going to say.
This version of her tale ends when rumours of her activities reach papal authorities. That's to say, the Pope. The church was besieged and Julia was tortured into a confession in which she admitted her role in the deaths of over 600 men over 2 decades. That was apparently her guess at how many customers she had sold to. If the numbers are accurate...
It's a lot.
Yeah. If they are accurate, this would make Julia, indirectly, a killer with one of the highest known body counts.
Hmm.
However, much like the case of Elizabeth Bathory, who we covered last season, it's hard to say how much of this confession can be relied on as the truth because of the torture involved.
Yes. Yeah, exactly.
So this could also be a convenient opportunity for authorities to come up with like an easy answer to many unsolved deaths and sort of confirm this with the suspect's admission under extreme duress.
And that's quite common at the time, really, because it's just it's easier.
People are lazy.
No one's ever gonna know.
Yeah.
So you might as well. It's not like now where it's like there'll be investigations and shit. So
nevertheless, with Julia's guilt certain, it's thought that she, along with a few underlings, including her daughter Girolamo, were taken to Campo de' Fiori, a square in Rome popular for public execution at the time. This version of events would have happened in July of 1659 and has Julia dying alongside her daughter.
Hmm.
Whatever may or may not have happened surrounding Julia's death, and however many victims really were out there, the aftermath left the authorities on the hunt for more of Julia's customers. Several who were caught claimed they had bought Acqua Tofana innocently as makeup, not intending to use it as a poison.
Sounds like bollocks.
Well, I had no idea. Yeah, I feel like it's not the kind of thing that you can accidentally, that you would be allowed to accidentally buy.
Yeah,
as well.
I mean, I know that some of these components, was it arsenic, was quite common to use in makeup.
And lead.
But the combination sold concealed as something that it isn't, it's just
slightly
it's like, okay, pull the other one, love.
Yeah, so at the time, as you were saying, and for the next few hundred years, heavy metals like arsenic and lead were very common ingredients in cosmetics.
Mm.
So arsenic was used to lighten the appearance of skin, while mercury and lead were used in eyeshadows.
Mm.
Obviously, all of this was incredibly bad for your skin and led to many health problems.
Yes, yeah. I mean, imagine now just being like, I'll just pick up some arsenic, quickly lighten my skin. It's just wrong. Or like, I'm just going to put some lead on my eyes real quick.
Yeah, I read a whole book on the history of makeup, which is fascinating, actually. But it's like hundreds of years of people just doing terrible things to their skin.
Mysteriously dying.
Yeah. So while pleading ignorance may have worked in a few cases, plenty of Julia's customers still ended up jailed or executed.
Hmm.
Mostly, as is the case throughout most of history, this worked out along class lines. So yeah. Julia's wealthy customers were imprisoned or let go with a slap on the wrist, while her lower class customers were sentenced to death, and around 40 of them were executed.
Hmm.
But I think it's interesting, while it's obviously tragic to think of how the punishment is sort of doled out according to your position in society, it's interesting to note that women of the upper class and the lower class are facing the same issues with regard to domestic abuse and having
and the lack of agency in marriage. Yeah.
Mm. The legend of Aqua Tofana remains strong long after the deaths of Julia and of her mother, the inventor of the poison. While it's most likely that Mozart died of disease, though his death actually remains undetermined, the man himself believed he was being poisoned, and specifically with Aqua Tofana.
Hmm.
"I feel definitely that I will not last much longer. I am sure that I have been poisoned," he claimed. "Someone has given me Aqua Tofana and calculated the precise time of my death."
Interesting tidbit.
Yeah, I didn't know that Mozart's death was such a disputed thing.
It is. I mean, for me, this still fits in with my strong feeling about the cause of his death, which is syphilis.
Mm.
Because with syphilis, you sort of lose your mind when it attacks the brain. So it would make sense for him to be a bit paranoid and think he's being poisoned and have a few delusions and stuff like that. That would be classic syphilis.
Syphilis.
So, I mean, I think a lot of people believe it was syphilis, but you can never prove it, of course. But
yeah,
it's quite a common disease at the time, and he got around, as far as I understand.
Yeah, it wouldn't be shocking. Let's put it that way. So that's that for the life and crimes of Julia Tofana. So I realize I've done a lot of older, more historical cases this season, which I do always find interesting, but I'd love to hear what our listeners think, whether you guys enjoy the variety of switching between more modern cases and older ones, or what kind of cases you'd like to see more of, if you'd prefer, just to get a sense of what you guys are interested in.
Yeah, I feel like we rarely do anything that's happened within the last 10 years. And I was thinking about looking at some things that have happened really recently. The only reason not to, and the reason why mostly I don't gravitate towards them, is because with newer stuff, there's often less information, funnily enough.
Yeah.
But I mean, we've done a few 2000s.
I realized, like, I hadn't planned on doing so many old cases this season, and I realized that the most recent one I did was like 1922.
Yes.
So.
But they're classic. They're interesting. They are interesting because you get that very different flavor of crime that comes out the social and cultural context of the time.
I'm glad you enjoy them in any case. But yeah, I was thinking maybe we'll put out a sort of poll or something after the season ends to get a sense of what you guys like and would want to see more or less of in the upcoming seasons.
Yeah, and as always, if there's a case that, because we've done it before, if there's a case that someone's interested in, bring it to our attention, because there's a good chance that we will have a look at it.
All right. Well, Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this episode. Don't forget to subscribe to this channel wherever you listen to podcasts. We're also on social media, which is a great place where you can connect with us, send us your opinions.
Is it a great place, though?
It's a terrible place, but it enables conversation and exchange.
Yes.
So we'd love to hear from you. We're on Twitter at About Murder, on Instagram at A Podcast About Murder, on Facebook, it's A Podcast About Murder with no E. We're also on YouTube. If you search for the podcast, you'll find us there. And we also have an email address, which is apodcastaboutmurder@outlook.com. So next week we'll be having our season finale.
Yes, it might end up being a two-parter. I mean, to say it might, I was just looking at the episode 4 and how long that recording turned out to be. And this one is 35% longer than that one.
I was surprised how long episode 3 was, to be honest. So, like, I've no idea. Yeah.
So I feel like we're going to get two finales in a sense. So that should be fun.
Yeah, so we'll be having 7 episodes, actually, this season, in a way.
So you get a little bit, just that tasty little morsel extra of us, which I know is what everybody craves. So that's good, yeah.
Do you want to hint to the final episode?
So the final episode will be a serial killer, and it will be one that many, many people are familiar with. Very classic, well-known 70s. Oh, 70s, 80s, serial killer. I can't remember. But you know what I mean? Those American, classic American serial killers that everyone is interested in, mightily interested in. So should be good.
All right. And on that note, have a good weekend.
Have a good weekend. See you soon. Bye.